Jamaica, fighting the system like a true modern day Robin Hood.
Good morning.
What's up?
How are you?
Pretty good.
Are you up?
I'm awake.
We're going early today. Well, for you.
Actually, it's earlier for you, isn't it?
Well, it is earlier for both of us.
Yeah. But I mean, it's 10:30 here.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've been up since 7 o'clock, I think.
So we could have started even earlier?
Well, actually, Kara's going away this morning, so she was getting ready and I was helping her. And
oh.
She left about an hour ago, so... And then I took the dog out for a little quick extra walk in case she had some... Business to take care of.
Well, it's been a while since we recorded.
It has, yeah. It's been at least a month, right?
Yeah, it's been a while. I had one pocketed, so it didn't seem like a month to the listeners, but...
Yeah.
I'm going to release this one as soon... Like today, so...
Nice.
Because we got behind, and if you want, we can record a short one tomorrow. I mean, not tomorrow. What the hell am I talking about? Next week, if you can, to get back on track.
Okay. Yeah, because you're doing a lot of podcasting this weekend, aren't you?
Yeah, I did one last night, even though Daryl's in Boston.
Right.
So he wasn't there, although we called him in. He was drunk off his ass.
I saw pictures on Twitter that one of the Chris's took. I wasn't sure which one it was, but took of them talking on the phone to you guys.
Yeah. So we did that one, and then today I got Retro and Geek Brunch.
Oh, my God.
They're offsetting now because we missed that one because of Easter, you know?
Ah, okay.
So there was just a lot going on.
Yeah, gotcha. Yeah, that's and plus you worked yesterday, right?
Yeah, plus I worked for about 5 hours. Not too much, but still had to go in, and that throws off my whole schedule because I like to read about 40 comics a week.
Yeah.
And I'm only at 20 now, so.
Well, I just had to point that out because I want, you know, all the listeners to know the dedication you have bringing the podcasts to the masses.
Well, I do it because I enjoy it.
What's the time in? Oh, yeah. I mean, of course.
If I didn't enjoy talking comics, I wouldn't do it.
No. No, why would you? It's not like you're getting paid for it, right?
Yeah.
The payments and the pleasure of talking to all your brilliant co-hosts.
Yep. So you had a birthday recently. What did you do?
I actually flew to Washington, D.C. on my birthday.
Nice.
Yeah, it worked out pretty cool because Kara was sent for a conference for work. So we flew down earlier on Sunday so she'd have some time also to do some sightseeing. And like Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, she had conferences during the day and stuff. And have you ever seen Lost in Translation, the movie?
Yeah, I thought it's got my woman in it, Scarlett.
Yeah.
Of course I've seen it.
That's one of my favorite movies. Because I like her, but I like Bo Murray too.
I like that movie just from the sheer culture difference of it. I don't know. It's like somebody just going somewhere and doing something different. And it was both of them, you know?
Right. Yeah, I mean, I like the cast. Besides Giovanni Ribisi, I'm not really a fan of his. But I've never been to Japan, but I like Japan and Japanese culture and stuff. And like I like how they just form this friendship and everything. But, you know, so Scarlett Johansson's character is basically there with her boyfriend. Her boyfriend's the one that's working, and she's just kind of hanging around. That's why she has time to hang out with Bill Murray. So I said, I'm your Scarlett Johansson, Kara. Because I'm just kind of hanging around.
You just hang out, and you go visit the Smithsonians while she's at work. Yeah.
Lay around on bed in transparent underwear. And But yeah, so yeah, Monday. The only thing was,
but you don't want to be Scarlett Johansson because she was essentially ignored by her husband.
Yeah, I don't want that part of it.
You don't want that part,
right? Yeah. Although I was hoping like Bill Murray would show up to hang out with me, but yeah. But yeah, I kind of overdid it on Monday though. The first day that, you know, I was kind of doing my own thing, I went down to you know, and went through a bunch of the art museums, and I started with the National Gallery, and you can basically see the history of European Western art from start to finish in that place.
Mm-hmm.
And I made a point of just seeing everything, so I walked literally through every single room in the place, and I wish I had had a pedometer on, because I mean, after that I went to two other art museums, and the next couple days, I did some stuff on Tuesday, but Wednesday I hardly did anything because my legs were throbbing so bad.
Wow.
I mean, I just really
overdid it. You're on your feet the whole day. What you should have done is like go and then take a lunch and then go some more.
Yeah, I mean, I did sit down for lunch and stuff like that, but I just still, I probably should have broken it up, like did some museums and then in the afternoon picked something to do that was like sitting down, you know.
Well, does your job require a lot of sitting down like mine? Like
yeah.
Computer all day?
I sit all day, so.
Yeah, so, yeah, that's it.
I mean, I'm trying to get, a few years ago, I was in the habit of exercising pretty regularly on the treadmill.
Mm-hmm.
It's the only time in my life that, you know, because I really didn't, you know, have to work out growing up or anything like that, and I felt fine, but, you know, after a certain age, you know, you kind of start to feel it. So I never had good habits as far as exercise and stuff. And only once in my life a couple years ago did I actually get in a habit for a while of getting on the treadmill and stuff.
Yeah.
And ever since then, I think I got a bad cold for a while. And
that's what happened to me.
Yeah.
In other words, I dropped out. Because once you're in the role of doing it over and over again, it's part of your routine.
Yeah, and you crave it almost.
Yeah, and you crave it. And then you fall into like a funk, like you get sick or something. And I was sick for a month.
Yeah.
And I just got out of it, but I need to get back into it.
And that's why I'm always saying, yeah, I got to get back into it. We have a treadmill, and I do it every once in a while. I have yet to get back in a regular habit, but with most things, in my experience, as long as I'm consistent in saying I'm going to do it, it actually does eventually happen. It might seem like it's not from people around, but and I might say it like 20 or 30 times without it happening, but at some point, for some reason, it clicks, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I'm not, like Kara's saying, that we should have measured. We should have weighed me before we went and before I got back. I think my jeans are looser.
Did you get to visit any comic shops or retro things? Like some of the Smithsonian's or?
Yeah, I did stop at a comic shop. There's a subway stop at this place called Union Station. It's pretty close to the Capitol. And it's kind of it's a mall. Right there, like you can get off the subway and just walk right into the mall, or you can go outside. And I kind of just searched, you know, Google Maps for comic shops and stuff, and saw one was there. It's Phantom, Fantom, comics in Union Station, and you know, it's in a mall, so it was a really small place, but they were using the space really well. They had stuff packed in everywhere. Not in a sloppy way. I was surprised at how well organized everything was, but they had a lot of stuff, and it was kind of cool that they had the visibility of being in the mall. And the woman that was working there, woman or young woman, she's probably in her early 20s or something, she was really cool. Like, she was really friendly, talking to me when I came in. I told her I was visiting from out of town, and so I'll talk about it today, actually. but I wanted to buy something just to support the shop while I was in there, and I forgot that they had released another trade of old Animal Man.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've had the first three volumes, which is the Grant Morrison run for a while, because they released them a long time ago, and then all of a sudden, I guess maybe because of the new 52 Animal Man, they released a fourth volume, which I haven't read anything of after the Morrison stuff, so I picked up that while I was there, and the woman working there was talking to me about the new 52 Animal Man and asking if I was reading it and enjoying it and stuff, and you know, was, because she said, like, what type of stuff do you read and everything, and earlier on, that's when I told her I was visiting from out of town, just wanted to check out the shop and stuff, but then when I bought Animal Man, she's like, oh, okay, I see. She said, now I know when I see somebody likes Animal Man, I can tell what kind of comics they like or something like that. in a good way, I guess. She said she was a fan, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a cool little shop, and I guess, like I said, I saw a lot of art, you know, and I saw some of the monuments. I've been there before, but the last time I did the museums and stuff was when I was in fifth grade. My class went on a trip.
Yeah.
And so it was cool to see certain things again, and it was Kara's first time there, really. So we went down at night, and it was when the cherry blossoms were in full bloom.
Right.
So that was cool to see. We did go into the American History Museum, Smithsonian, and they we saw a pretty cool exhibit of America throughout the wars, and you walked through, and it took you through every conflict that America's been involved in. One of the things that was interesting was just they had uniforms and stuff set up in these glass cases. It reminded me kind of like the Robin costumes in the Batcave.
Yeah.
Those were really cool to see, and it's interesting. You get a sense of the size of people.
Mm-hmm.
And they also had an exhibit about the first ladies, and they had all the first ladies' dresses and stuff like that. So you could, like, old dresses and things that you could see, and you can kind of get a sense of, you know, like some of the first ladies weren't exactly attractive, and their style kind of matched that. Like, it'd be really kind of, you know, conservative and frumpy. And then you get to like Jackie Onassis's, or yeah. Jackie, she was Jackie Kennedy, obviously, at the time. You get to her like inaugural ball dress, and it's, you know, you could tell that she was real super thin and stylish, and which, as everybody knows, so that was kind of neat.
Yeah, I've been to that museum that you're talking about, maybe mm-hmm. 10 years ago, maybe mm-hmm. a little longer. Maybe it was 15, yeah. But I was on business trip, and I got to see that one.
Cool.
I got to see one, too, that went through the history of coin, or it had, like, coins, but they were forfeit coins, you know, forgery. The history mm-hmm. of forgery, that was awesome. I spent a lot of time in there.
Yeah.
It's like a fascinating thing, you know, how it's so, it's how far back it's gone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't go. I've never been to the Arlington Cemetery, and I wanted to go, but that was part of my being worn out.
Yeah.
That I didn't get around to that. And I had gone, it might have been like 2005 or something like that. I was there briefly, and we went with a group that went through the Holocaust Museum. So I had done that recently enough that I wanted to try to see stuff I hadn't seen in a while. But that's, I mean, someday I would like to go back through that again, though. But it was, I mean, one of the most, well, it's definitely the most depressing museum I've ever been in, because museums tend not to be depressing, but it was a very, like, overwhelming, very moving experience. Like, I've watched a lot of documentaries and stuff about the Holocaust and World War II and everything, but I think out of anything I've experienced, that museum is the thing that brought home the whole, I don't know what you want to call it, but phenomenon, or the whole thing, mm-hmm. The best, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I had a good time.
Good deal.
Yeah. So,
I also picked up a couple recent treasures. I got Batman number 3.
Yeah.
It's the first appearance of Catwoman in costume. But I didn't expect to see her in costume like that. Like, I didn't realize what her costume looked like. This is from 1940. I thought it was going to be the purple costume that I've seen with the whip and stuff. Mm-hmm. Like the old one with the dress.
Right.
But she actually had a cat face. I was pretty surprised to see that.
I don't think I've ever... You know, actually, I'm sitting here. I got a shelf next to me. And I just picked up Batman Chronicles Volume 2 because I thought it might be in there. Mm-hmm. I haven't read this yet, but yeah, it's the last issue in it is Batman 3.
Yeah,
if you throw, so I see what you're talking about now.
Yeah, if you go towards the back, which for 10 cents, you got a lot of comic book back then, man. Got like 80 pages, it seemed like. Mm-hmm. But I got it in pretty good shape. I was really happy with it. I mean, it's still good condition, maybe close to very good. The inside of it's beautiful. The cover is beautiful. It's the corner, the binding in the corner that kind of messes it up pretty bad. Mm-hmm. And then I picked up Batman number 18, which had Stalin and Hitler and is it Hirohito or on the cover? And then I picked up number 27, which had Santa Claus on the cover. So, and these are kind of cool because they have the buy war bonds on them.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, so they're old. They're definitely my oldest books.
Nice.
Before it was the Blue Beetle, but these are from 40, so it's a little earlier.
Wow. Would you see Batman number 3 as kind of the crown jewel of your collection now, or
definitely the oldest?
Yeah.
I don't know if it's the best or the most crown jewel because of the condition, mm-hmm. but it's up there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, my comic shop just acquired a lot of Golden Age stuff.
Yeah.
And he was going to give me 50% off of what he was getting for it. I mean, so I took advantage of it and did it. I probably mm-hmm. won't do that again for a while.
Yeah, I guess you got to pace those kind of purchases out.
Yeah. And then I picked up the new Teen Titans number 2, which I was missing, which is the first appearance of Deathstroke. I was missing that one. Like, I think that was like the only one. I might be missing like one other issue, and then I have a complete run. And it's some oddball issue. It's not a popular one like this. It's just like number 40 or something. I don't know. Mm-hmm. And then I picked up The Scorpion, which I'll talk about today, which was a Howard Chaykin creation for Atlas Comics, 1975. And then I picked up Bullseye, Charlton Bullseye, the first 4 issues. That one was, it had a Captain Atom and Blue Beetle thing in question. And then some other weird, obscure stuff like cartoon characters and stuff. And what else did I pick? I picked up something else, but I can't remember what it is. So I got some older stuff.
Nice. Yeah, I posted a picture a couple months ago. I picked up that same New Teen Titans issue along with number 1 and the DC Universe Presents with the 16-page preview in there just to kind of complete... I didn't have those early issues, and then I think my run only goes up to the beginning of the New Titans, just that first Who is Donna Troy story,
right?
And then then I have all of the Geoff Johns issues of the like 2002 or 3 issue or whatever it was, but at some point I started rereading that Titans run, and probably when I get closer to where my run stops, I'll probably maybe start picking up and filling in some of the stuff in between there.
Yeah. I I always wanted that one. I just could never find a good deal on it. And this time I did, because he had acquired 3 copies of it, all in really good shape. And because he had so many of them, he gave it for a really good price.
Nice. Yeah, because I think that might have...
The book skyrocketed. I mean, it went up in price a lot during the identity crisis because Deathstroke was so prominent in it.
Yeah.
Like, that's when he took on the entire Justice League and methodically took out each one in one fight scene.
Yeah.
It was pretty awesome. Like, karate chopped to Zatanna's throat. She couldn't say anything.
Yeah, that's the combination of the phenomenon of number twos a lot of times being rarer than number ones. And then if you put the introduction of a really popular character in it on top of that, it's just, I'm pretty sure, I know I paid more for that than for number one.
Yeah.
That tends to happen a lot with number twos. Low print runs and stuff when the book hasn't taken off yet or anything, but... Yeah, it's funny. The one thing that's always funny is rereading those Titans issues before that transitional period for Dick Grayson, is that, you know, George Perez's style is so anatomically accurate.
Yeah.
That, you know, he doesn't look like a kid. He looks like, you know, he's 19 or 20 years old. So he really does look like a 19 or 20 year old guy wearing the Robin costume,
which is awkward.
Yeah, and you know, they right from the beginning, Cyborg sort of teases him about it and everything, and it really does look odd on him, which I guess, you know, drives home his whole choice to take on the Nightwing identity. But yeah. It's pretty funny.
Yeah, I just read. This doesn't fall into retro because I think it just came out like several years ago, but it was that New Teen Titans Games by Marv Wolfman and Perez, the one that they released. It's pretty awesome. Like, the art in it is definitely very detailed George Perez, but like, in this one, Nightwing is wearing his disco collar. Make Keith happy.
Yeah, I have that, but I haven't read it yet. But yeah, I think...
Yeah, I was sitting on my coffee table, and I was like, damn, I should just read this damn thing. And once I got into it, I really got into it, and I finished it, like, in one sitting. It was good. I liked it a lot. Made me miss the old DC, kind of, you know, just a little bit anyway. Like, I understand this one's, like, building a new thing, and that's kind of cool. But I miss the old because it always built on itself.
Right.
You can even find links back to pre-crisis, you know, because they didn't just throw away everything before it. Crisis on Infinite Earths merged everything.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a different sort of approach. Yeah, there definitely are parallels and similarities and whatnot, but there are huge differences as well. You know, it's more of a synthesis of, you know, and in some ways, I mean, they did with the way that they kept continuity of Batman and Green Lantern is sort of similar to the way that they kept continuity in some ways from Crisis, from, you know, the different worlds. But I think the way that it came off in the New 52 is it didn't fit quite as neatly.
Yeah, I think they should have went all in or all out. In other words, they kind of cheated. They kind of said, well, our Batman properties and Green Lantern properties are successful, so we don't want to throw it all away.
Right.
But we're not too successful in this, so let's revamp the hell out of it. And it just made it weird.
Yeah.
But you still can't find a clean dividing line of what happened and what didn't happen.
No.
I just read the latest Batman, and I know this is retro, but it has something to do with the past, because in the latest Batman, he references, or maybe it was Batman and Robin, I can't remember, he references that he died and Superman died. Mm-hmm. So we know that Superman died from Doomsday, so plus he's died a lot in the Silver Age. but he died from Doomsday, and then Batman died in that Rest in Peace, which he didn't really die. He got blasted by Darkseid, right? But people thought he was dead, I guess.
Yeah, he got sent like
back into the caveman days. But he did reference that, so that obviously happened. It just confuses things more for me, though. Because it all happened in 5 years, because their universe is supposed to be like 5 years old.
Yeah, and that's ridiculous. I mean, they decided that and then just tried to make everything fit to that.
Yeah.
I think. You know, I'll never be convinced that the New 52 thing was planned out with enough time.
No, I think it was planned out with a lot of... I mean, it had time, a little bit of time, but it was planned out with desperation, I think.
Right.
Because of what was going on in the market on both sides of the fence.
Yeah.
It was just dropping and dropping and dropping, and they invigorated... I mean, it did what it was supposed to do, put new life into it. Now they're dwindling back down, and I'm sure we're going to see something happen.
Yeah.
In DC side anyway, because they had half of the market, and now they're starting to lose it again.
Mm-hmm. And while I'm personally a fan of seeing lesser-known characters and properties brought up and given attention, if I take off my fan hat and put on like a marketing hat, a lot of the stuff post like initial launch that they've added in other waves, I have to wonder what they're thinking as far as believing that some of these properties will take off.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I wish they would, but like I said, if I'm not looking at it as a fan and I'm just, and from personal taste, I'm just looking at it like, okay, if it was my job to launch new titles that I thought were going to sell and, you know, recapture some of that market share, you know, I some of the stuff that they're choosing, you know, you look at it and you're like, there's no way that that's going to last. That'll be canceled in 8 issues.
Yeah, like Vibe and Katana. Like, what made them think they could have Vibe successful?
Yeah.
And it's already starting in the bottom of the, you know, under 20K, and it's just going to drop from there. I like it. Like, I'm enjoying both those books, but I like you, or, hey, take more chances, but if it was my job, I wouldn't.
Right.
I'd be launching more Superman, Batman, and stuff like that. And then maybe launching these, but doing it in such a way that I might not hurt the book so much or take a loss.
Yeah, like only do one or two at a time that you're really going to have to push and put marketing dollars behind to get people interested in. And then, you know, because I think there was like one wave where like seven out of eight of the books or something like that were, you know, kind of questionable as to whether they were going to last. And that's asking too much for people to try that many new, you know, not just that they're new number ones, but new ideas and new or less familiar.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. Who knows?
All right. You want to talk some comics?
Sure.
I read The Scorpion. I'm starting to become a real big fan of Howard Chaykin. I've always been a fan, but I just like his art. Even though some people don't like it or they say good Howard Chaykin, bad Howard Chaykin, I think it's consistent Howard Chaykin. this is some of his early work, 1975, and Atlas was kicking off, and man, they were like a brand new universe. Because they were kicking off with Iron Jaw, The Grim Ghost, Phoenix, Wolf the Barbarian, Planet of the Vampires, Target, all kinds of titles. Morlock, The Cougar, Scorpion, all kinds of different titles I'd never even heard of, you know. I've heard of Grim Ghost, Phoenix, and Wolf because I bought the relaunch of the Atlas characters, which I thought was very, very mediocre so far. But this title, looked pretty damn awesome. The cover looked awesome. His style has changed over the years. He was very, very detailed back then. And now his faces look a little pudgier. And he's got a different style. He's still drawing very sexy women because Black Kiss was, man, that was nasty, but it was awesome. But this story is pretty simplistic, but yet if I take it out of its context in 1975, it's probably ahead of its time. But it's about a mercenary, a weird mercenary, because mercenaries usually pay and they'll do what you know, whatever you ask them to do, mm-hmm. if it's within their ethical boundaries. This guy, he pays just to do good. But for some reason, this guy's airline, he's like flying like the two-seat passenger planes shipping product from point A to point B. And they're getting shot out of the air and crashing, and nobody knows why. The pilots are always dead, even though they have chutes and stuff. Why didn't they eject? And this guy, for the plane company, hires the Scorpion to find out what's going on. So the Scorpion goes up in one plane, and they have like this weird silencer gun that nobody can see, and I guess it shoots a sonic thing and causes the pilot just to freak out and crash. But Scorpion's a badass, you know, a fighter pilot, and he kind of like shoots them out of the sky, and then he uncovers the plot to this what other guy's trying to take out this plane company so he can make more profit. And then these two guys are pissed because their plane went down, like that was their plane, and they were mercenaries hired by another company. So they capture the Scorpion's girlfriend, which is really hot. She's smoking, and she works with him. She's like an adventurer. They're like a husband and wife adventure team. And anyway, it's a done in one. Even though there were three issues of this in existence, I guess everything Atlas did wasn't very successful at all. But it is an interesting historical book just to learn about what was going on. And the Howard Chaykin art is what makes this book like really awesome.
Was that a shared universe, Atlas? Like,
yeah, I think so.
Uh-huh. So was this, like, Scorpion wasn't a Chaykin character? Or was it? Did he create the character? Do you know?
He created the character for Atlas. He probably owns it still. I don't know, because you know how there's those copyright laws. If you don't use a character, then it goes in public domain, and I don't know.
Yeah, or trade, like the trademarks, at least I think, or something like that.
But one of the books he did for Vertigo that I really, really loved was American Century.
Yeah.
And all his books that he does are very much in the similar. He likes to do stuff in periods, like in period pieces and stuff. Like he did a lot of Black Hawk for DC as well, which I don't have a full run of it, but I have read it and enjoyed it, which I should go back and complete now that his style is really growing on me. But yeah, this is one that I want to try to hunt down, the Scorpion. It's probably going to be kind of hard just because, not because it's worth anything, but just mm-hmm. because finding something that, especially an issue two.
Yeah, and may just be lack of, you know, print run or something.
Yeah, but I was glad I picked it up, and it was really, really good shape, like it just came off the shelf.
Nice. Yeah, I don't think I've heard of that one. I mean, I'm not very familiar with. I mean, I'm familiar with Chaykin's style and what it looks like, and I can. It's pretty easy to recognize his style. So it's, you know, saying that I can pick something out if it's by him isn't saying much, because it's pretty. He's got a unique style, I would say.
Yeah, I had to send you a picture of what this looks like though, because you could definitely see his style there.
Mm-hmm.
But man, it's a lot different.
Hmm.
It's his style, but done more like George Perez type.
Okay.
Art detail, yeah.
So it's not as characterized.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the right word, but it's not as. I mean, I feel like his stuff really has a unique look to it that you don't mistake for anybody else's work, you know.
Yeah.
But a lot of times when you look at an artist's early stuff, you can tell that it's by them, but you can tell that they also, don't have everything completely worked out yet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're still kind of developing, you know, working out their influences and getting a style that's unique to themselves, you know.
Yeah. It was a 25-cent cover price. It must have flopped, like, really, really bad because the third issue isn't even by Howard Chaykin.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's by some guy, Gabriel Levy, who I've never heard of.
Yeah.
And the art on the second issue, interesting, isn't Howard Chaykin art. It has some big artists on here. Get this. Number two has Bernie Wrightson, Michael Kaluta, and Walt Simonson.
Wow. All in one issue, huh?
Yeah, all in one issue.
That's interesting. It'll be interesting to see how they, you know, if it's all one continual story or what.
So that was cool. What have you got?
Well, I already mentioned it, so I'll talk about Animal Man. Like I said, I was familiar with and had read a while ago the first three trades, and I think so that's issues 1 through 26 of Animal Man, which is pretty well known. That's Grant Morrison. It's really early Grant Morrison as far as doing American comics. I never got around to picking up issues after 26, even though most of them aren't that valuable. You can get them for a dollar or whatever. And I may have done that with these issues, but like I said, I was looking around for something to pick up at the shop to support them. It's not a bad deal for $20. There's 10 issues. And
what did it run through? 27 through
37? This is, 27 through 37. And what's kind of weird about that is, I think they were looking to offer it at a good value for sales purposes, because its stopping point is kind of a cliffhanger. It doesn't really doesn't stop in such a way that you would feel like it's a standalone volume. I don't know if, you know, what the sales were like for this. I don't know if they'll do other volumes. I may just at some point, if I get around to it, just at this point go to single issues. There's two different writers here. First we have, I think it's 6 issues, written by Peter Milligan. And you know, if the Grant Morrison run, I would say had sort of two tones to it. There was one tone where it was a little more, straightforward superhero, but yet still with some imaginative ideas. And then, especially later on in his run, it got really, really experimental and more like metatextual, because he was dealing with ideas of narrative and stuff, and spoiler, Buddy Baker ends up meeting a Grant Morrison character and kind of leaping out of the page. There's a famous page in one of the issues where it's just Buddy Baker, just a portrait of him looking out of the comic page at you, the reader. So what I found interesting was that, he kind of leaves it in such a way that you'd wonder how somebody would pick things back up after that. And I found that Peter Milligan did a pretty good job. His story, the issues that are written by him, do form kind of a single story that essentially deals with Buddy wakes up after, so this is happening after he met his creator or his writer, essentially. And he wakes up out of a coma, and he's basically in an alternate reality. Nothing is as he expects it to be, and you know, his wife Ellen, who, you know, they had a really great relationship, she kind of hates him. She's cheating on him. She's taken up smoking. His daughter doesn't really recognize him.
How did he end up in the coma? I don't remember.
I believe it's implied that it was as a result of the shock to his system of meeting Grant Morrison.
Oh, okay. that would probably shock me too.
Yeah, like sort of like, you know, coming face to face with God or something like that, which I thought was kind of a
coming face to face with his creator. Well, yeah. He didn't really create Animal Man, but
right.
He definitely made him prominent.
Right.
Because in Strange Adventures, he was kind of more like your stereotypical guy with powers.
Yeah. Yeah, so I thought that was kind of a neat way to transition off of an ending that seemed like it would be a hard ending to continue on from. To have there be a consequence for such a significant event. And the other thing that he's dealing with is that his animal powers, which he tends to always be having problems with, he's finding himself actually being sort of taken over by animalistic traits. Most shockingly, when he does some funny things, like some of it's funny, some of it's horrible. Like he walks out to the front of the house and just takes a leak on the sidewalk. And at first he doesn't think he did anything wrong by pissing on their at the entrance to their house, because he just felt like he was marking his territory. And then, you know, then he'll come back and realize, oh, what the fuck am I doing?
Why did I pee on? He got a dog instinct, and it's like, I'm just going to put my...
Yeah, mark his scent.
That'll get you shot in today's world.
Yeah, he does it in broad daylight, and his wife's freaking out. Like, what are the neighbors? Because they're supposed to, like, have company arriving any minute. And he's like, his son's cracking up. He said, "You just took a leak on the sidewalk, Dad." And Buddy says, "Geez, I don't know. I was just, laying down a bit of scent. I'm home now, and, you know, I thought I'd just mark out my home base a little." And so then, like, on the next page, all of a sudden, you know, he's still, like, doesn't... At first, he's, like, cleaning it off with the hose. And then it suddenly shocks him into realization what he just did. But more shockingly, later on, he's invited, you know, he's an animal rights activist and stuff, and he's invited to appear at this event for animal rights and stuff like that. And it happens to him again, where he rushes a mounted policeman, and the policeman gets thrown from the horse, and he chases the horse down, tackles it, and just takes a big old bite out of the horse's neck. And so that's how issue 27 ends, with him standing there with blood all over him in front of this crowd of animal rights activists. So he meets this guy who speaks. He's called what the hell is he called? He's drawn like he's coming apart, and he speaks. He has a really strange speech pattern, where, you know, it's based on like William Burroughs, the author of Naked Lunch. It's based on his like cut up approach to writing, where he would write something and then rearrange the letters or rearrange the words. And that's kind of how this guy talks. Like, you can get the sense of what he's trying to say, but you have to kind of read. Like, for example, he says, "I left, changed my name, should have called myself All Over the Place Man, but I always liked Scorpion Crawling the Beatles." So it's like, it starts to make sense, and then it stops making sense, and sometimes it'll go in and out of making sense. And He ends up kind of teaming up and helping Animal Man when get back to his own reality, which involves entering this jungle where there's an original version of him, and he has to reconnect with and find his way back to his own reality. But it kind of amounts to the whole concept of how there's in physics, how there's always, every time you make a decision, you create a new path. Mm-hmm. And basically, he woke up in the wrong path, and he has to get back to the one that he recognizes. And when he does so, that's when Tom Veitch takes over as writer. And by this point, Steve Dillon, who would go on to do Preacher and stuff, is the penciler. And that's the rest of the issues in the volume. And this kind of reminded me a little bit more of like the earlier part of Morrison's run, where it's still got its concepts that are a little bit strange and weird, but
it's more grounded.
It's a little more straightforward storytelling and a little more grounded. And it does also deal with him trying to get a hold of his powers now that he's gotten back to his own reality. He meets a guy who starts doing tests on him and helping him get his powers back under control. And it introduces the whole idea of the matrix of animal powers that he accesses, that I think is still part of what...
Is that the red? Did he introduce the red?
The red, I believe, is after Tom Veitch stops...
Delano introduces it.
Jamie Delano, when he comes along, it gets a little bit more of like a horror.
That's when I really dug it. I think when Delano came. It's been so long ago that I've read these, but
yeah,
they're gonna come out with an omnibus, and I bet you they just stop with Grant Morrison. But it would be nice when they come out with these omnibus if they just finish it.
Right. Yeah, I'd like to at some point in near future, finish, because like I said, it ends kind of abruptly, where something happens that he thinks that he may have caused all the animals in the San Diego Zoo to die.
Yeah, I remember that issue.
Yeah, but that, and then it just kind of ends there. But like I said, I mean, I may just pick up single issues because they're not that expensive. But yeah, I enjoyed it. I actually read pretty much the whole thing on the plane, because it's supposed to only be an hour flight, but there were bad storms that night. So we actually were sitting on the plane for several hours waiting to take off.
Mm-hmm.
So thankfully I'd bought that. I pretty much read the whole trade. But yeah, I liked it. I mean, I would definitely... Anybody out there that was like me that only read the Morrison stuff, I think this is similar enough in tone, but introduces some new ideas that be worth picking up the trade or picking up the issues and continuing to read.
So that one was, that time period was 1990 to... Did that cover all of Veitch's issues? 1990 to...
No.
Oh, okay.
That's why I say it kind of stops abruptly in the middle. I feel like, if this was, if they were trading something that just came out, they might have only done the 6 issues of Milligan's run, but yeah, since it's older. But yeah, it stops at 37.
It's a good price for freaking $19.
Yeah.
And if you would have got a discount on it, I mean, that would probably like $10.
Yeah, yeah. If you
10 issues is great. I mean, mm-hmm, even that's like $2 an issue.
Yep,
that's great.
Yeah, so it's not a bad buy. It's why, even though I knew I could get it for probably cheaper online, I wanted to buy something while I was at visiting the store.
And something that you're gonna read, right? You wanted to read it for the plane, so.
Yeah, it worked out well that way, and I have I have the first three volumes, so you know they designed it so it looks like you wouldn't be able to tell that many years passed between them releasing the volumes. Mm-hmm. 3 and 4 pretty much look they fit in nicely on the shelf. So
I read a whole trade as well, and this is something that I knew existed, and I only have like 3 issues of it, but I've always been curious to read it. And it is Green Goblin, a lighter shade of green trade, which covers Green Goblin 1 through 13, Web of Spider-Man 125, Spectacular Spider-Man 225, and Amazing Scarlet Spider number 2. Mm. It's mostly, the majority of it's by Tom DeFalco, which okay. I like his writing a lot, and then illustrated by Scott McDaniel. I'm hit or miss on Scott McDaniel. Like, I really liked his Nightwing, and some other stuff I really like and some I don't. This one is somewhere in between. Like, he draws the Green Goblin really, really well, but there's some panels where action's going on, and I don't know what the fuck is going on. Like, I get the idea, but it just looks really weird. But this is the story of Phil Urich, which is Ben Urich, you know, the famous reporter that works with Daredevil and covers a lot of shit for the Daily Bugle. Phil Urich is his nephew, and he's kind of a loser dude. Like, he's got nothing really going for him, and Ben gets him a job at the Daily Bugle as an intern, because back in the day, during this time frame, they had like lots of interns, the Daily Bugle. And it's really cool how they introduce this character, because it is kind of unique. But he kind of spawns off at the time when Ben O'Reilly was Spider-Man. Like, during this clone event, Ben O'Reilly is in prison taking the blame for something that went on, which, because this was like crossed over with like Web of Spider-Man and other stuff, it was hard to gauge without having read those issues what exactly happened. But you get the general feel that he took the bullet for Peter and went to prison while Peter's out, and then Peter's wearing the Scarlet Spider costume, so it's very, very strange what happens. But this scene opens up with the origin of this character is both the Osborns are dead. So, you know, I don't think they're dead now. Well, obviously, Norman. No. And is his son back too? I can't remember.
I don't know, actually.
But at this point in time, they're both dead, and there is no Green Goblin. And Ben Urich is trying to uncover the Green Goblin's hideout, even though the Green Goblin's not around anymore. And Phil actually uses his research. He's kind of a shady dude. He hangs out with this other dude, and they get in trouble a lot by this guy called Rico the Sicko. And he goes to the warehouse and runs into Ben almost getting killed, because Ben was doing research there too. And he had given all the information to this criminal dude, and he felt bad about it because Ben was going to get killed because of what he did. And he runs into this warehouse, this one room, which is obviously where the Green Goblin had a hidden room, because nobody else found this room. And it has this huge vat of green substance and then the costume. And what happens is he ends up immersed in or hitting this jar, this container, and then it immerses him in that chemical, and then that chemical allows him to put on the Green Goblin costume and have super strength. So all his powers and abilities are based on that costume, but only he can bind himself to the costume through that whatever chemical he absorbed. And he's got like super strength, he's got like a laugh that will just make you want to vomit and become discombobulated. And He's got the glider, obviously, but he's got like no talent whatsoever. Like, what do you do if you're a hero that all your everything that about you is based on technical capability and you have none of it yourself? Like, how much pumpkin bombs did they make? You know, how many? If once your glider runs out of energy, or how do you do that? Well, that's probably why this guy only lasted 13 issues, but he was like a reluctant hero. He didn't want to do bad. He didn't want to do good. He just wanted to be there. He thought it was cool to fly on the glider and all that. But he ended up doing some good things and saving some lives. And but it always seemed more circumstantial than actually wanting to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And he had, you know, runs in with Daredevil and Spider-Man and Sentinels, believe it or not, because the tail end of this series was around the Onslaught time period. Onslaught, I think, was the character that took on the Avengers and the X-Men and or the Fantastic Four and actually launched the Jim Lee and Rob Liefeld books.
Oh, God, yeah.
The Onslaught universe. Mm-hmm. So this had a lot of time references, and then it was kind of cool how during the whole, the supporting cast were the interns, and he fell in love with this one intern, but she was just using him to get stories, and he was so stupid he never realized it because he was always infatuated with her. And then there was another girl there that really wanted to like him, and nothing ever happened because he was so infatuated with the first girl, the first intern. And she didn't want to really give him the time of the day. She wanted to use him for information because Ben Urich was uncovering a lot of information. But it had a cool story with Liz Osborne, because Liz Osborne had put out in the public eye that she didn't like this Green Goblin because mm-hmm. that was her husband's and son's evil legacy, and she wanted it to stop. And he actually was going to turn the costume over to her. Uh-oh. And she ended up getting kidnapped and almost killed, and he saved her, and she was like, you keep it, you know, you're doing good stuff, keep doing it. But it's cool, and it ends up him fighting Sentinels, and he does it to the point where his glider's destroyed. Like, he sacrifices his glider, so he doesn't have a glider anymore. His mask is damaged because of the Sentinel bam, and he doesn't know how to fix this shit, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So in the last issue, he kind of like, he goes back to work. Everybody's getting laid off. All the interns are getting laid off. A lot of the reporters are getting laid off, because I guess during this period, it was like 1995, the papers were all hurting, I guess, because of, mm-hmm. you know, the technology was starting to get rid of papers. But anyway, they were de-staffing, like they cut the staff in half. You know, it just, you just had the big people at the Daily Bugle, like Robertson, you know, and what's his name? J. Jonah Jameson, and they kept Urich, but they got rid of all the interns and some of the other reporters. He gets back, everybody's losing their job. He decides, well, at least I'm gonna try to be the Green Goblin, and he tries to do it without any powers, because he's still got the costume, but he can't. Because the hood is all damaged, he can't access any powers. Like, his super strength is all gone. His laugh is all gone. He's really just him. He's like, well, Daredevil can do this. And he tries to stop the mugging, and he fails, like, miserably. Luckily, Spider-Man comes and saves the day, or else he would have got his ass kicked, because he just started throwing pumpkin bombs at these dudes. And then it's like, who's this fucker throwing fireworks at us? Let's go kick his ass. So they all go out for him to kick his ass, and Spider-Man saves the day. And then it kind of ends where he takes the costume, he goes by the warehouse, and he does that famous Spider-Man scene where Spider-Man throws his costume in the trash can and walks away. He kind of throws all his Green Goblin stuff in the trash can. And I guess Paul or Phil Urich becomes the Hobgoblin later on, and I think that's what we see him in now, because I remember in recent issues of Amazing Spider-Man, he's still around, and he's more of a jerk. He's more of a villain now than he is a hero.
Yeah.
He did have his day as a somewhat reluctant hero. And he did.
It's like almost a slacker.
Yeah, he's a slacker, and he did run across, and he did run into some money too, because he had this adventure with Arcade, where somebody hired Arcade to kill him, and Arcade is more about the game. Like he'll at the time he would try to kill you in his murder world, mm-hmm. but he thought of it: if you survive my murder world, you can just go. And he did, and he ended up with a whole knapsack of like a lot of money that Arcade was being paid in from some other guy that wanted him dead, and he has that whole knapsack of money. So he did fall into like a lot of money. But it's cool because he had like this friend who would always get him into trouble. He was like a techie guy that liked to play video games a lot. And damn it, the colorist could never get his hair right. Like this is only fucking 13 issues. And he went from blonde to redhead to black hair. I mean, he had every sort of color of hair that I've seen. And he was like one of the supporting cast. It never looked the same. Never. Sometimes he had a goatee. Sometimes he didn't.
I feel empathetic to this character, though. I mean, he seems like kind of like if I was a superhero, like he's like half committed, you know, not doing good accidentally. Has a friend that really likes video games.
He's the every man's hero.
Yeah.
When he did become a hero, he did it. He had alternative motives. In other words, he was trying to impress that intern girl.
Yeah.
So he would look like a hero, but and then when the Sentinels were out, he was just with his uncle because he didn't want to do shit. And then he ran into a situation where he had to. I guess he was a unique character in that. That's probably why he never took out. Because I think people in general either like heroes to be heroes and villains to be villains, and then there's a shade of gray. Well, I know Punisher's popular, and so is Ghost Rider, but it's harder for them to be successful.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess I kind of tend to be somewhat traditional. I mean, I'll read any kind of story as far as the story is good, but as long as I need kind of a balance after a little while, you know, I like to every once in a while read a story where heroes are heroes, you know, where it's just kind of, I mean, that's what I like about like a good Superman story or something where, you know, you see somebody trying to hold to ideals that are higher, you know?
Yeah. And I think I'm still friends with Scott McDaniel. I'm going to ask him if he's a Steeler fan because he always would draw the guy with the jacket with the Steeler emblem.
Oh, really?
On the shoulder.
And yeah, I wonder if he's – I don't know where he's from.
Yeah, I don't know. I was just going to send him an IM and just say, were you a Steeler fan or what? that. But he had some. He had one villain called Angel Face that was kind of interesting. She had a. it was a woman that would like look up rich people. She was the one that tried to take out Liz Osborne. You know, that's why the whole thing came out. This Angel Face, she was like a badass fighter, had no powers, who had two badass mercenaries with her called Salt and Pepper.
Yeah, oh, I know them. They talked about sex.
Yeah, let's talk about sex, baby. Let's talk about you and me. It was interesting, and it kept my interest enough for me to finish it. It was an expensive-ass trade, but I got it for half off. So it was a $40 trade. The paper was really thick, like 90s thick, or I don't know. It was really thick paper. But it had 13 issues. Well, 13, 14, 15, 16 issues for $40. But I got it for $20.
Oh, so. That's not bad. Yeah, I pretty much, you know, I miss most of the 90s in comics, at least. I do remember the actual 90s. But, so I miss all the Clone Saga stuff or things related to the Clone Saga, even though, you know, I've been a big Spider-Man fan, but that's a big gap in my knowledge of the character's history. I miss that whole era, and I haven't gone back and read any of it.
Me too. I must have dropped out I didn't drop out of comics. I must have dropped out of a lot of Marvel comics. Because I have all the DC mostly from that period, but I must have just said, the hell with Marvel, I don't want to do it anymore, or I can't keep caught up because of school or whatever, and just stopped. But I'd like to go, what I have read about the Clone Saga, I know it gets a lot of shit on, and it gets shit on, but I like it. Like, I like what they were doing, at least the pieces that I was reading.
And it does seem like there are people out there that are fans of it. I mean, it does get like made fun of a lot, but I know there are some vocal fans out there that appreciate it. I think maybe a lot of people, I mean, it's just a guess, but I think some people may have bad memories of it that were reading it at the time because it just went on and on. It was really, you know, it went on for a long period of time, and people maybe were ready for it to end.
Yeah.
But if you just, you know, if you're going back and reading it at your own pace, it might be a little bit more palatable that way.
Yeah, this went into a lot with the Jackal, too, and Gwen Stacy, like the clone. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of stuff that I missed. Like, I read that Gwen Stacy had sex with Norman Osborn issue, but I didn't read a lot of the clone stuff. So this was... this was very interesting to me. It was well worth the read. It was a good night read because there's not a lot of thinking. And right before bed, you know, knocking out 2 to 3 issues a night was it was a pretty good read.
Yeah, it can be. It's hard enough to stay awake reading comics sometimes, let alone stuff that's complex.
Yeah, I like to read before bed, but I don't like to read before bed something that's great because I'm already half asleep, or I'm already in a mode where I don't want to think because I was thinking all day.
Yeah.
And it was just like mindless entertainment. It was pretty cool.
Yeah, or if you're rereading something, sometimes that's good too. It depends on I like to too, but I'll go through a streak of nights where by the time I get into bed, I'm pretty tired, so I only read a few pages and I start falling asleep. I think it took me, I was rereading the first New Teen Titans annual that kind of wraps up the story, the first story with Blackfire.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it took me 3 nights to get, because it was an annual, so it was kind of, I kept falling asleep and having to go back and read the last couple pages I had read.
Yeah, this
I'll get through it.
the Spectacular Spider-Man issue was interesting too, because this one had art by Sal Buscema and Bill Sienkiewicz. He did the inks on it, and man, does it not! It looks so 90s. Like, do you remember Ghost Rider, the Danny Ketch? I can't remember who drew it, but it's got the real thick line and it's real dark. That's what it looked like. It didn't look like the Sal Buscema that I know.
Mm.
So, yeah, that was interesting. Cool. It's cool to, like, revisit this stuff, especially if you totally missed it the first time.
Yeah. Yeah, there's so much stuff that I want to go back and read. I could totally stop reading new stuff, and I'd have plenty of stuff to read.
You know what, though? I am becoming addicted to these new Image titles, man. There's some good shit.
I read a lot of
crap. There's some good stuff. I'm just doing the Bill thing now. Like, there's so many the titles that I'm missing out on from Image that I just said, fuck it. I'm going to buy every number one and try it. And we'll see if I like it. And if I like it, I'll add it. If I don't, I don't. But it's just that some of those number ones are so rare. Like, they're like 3,000 to 5,000 copies, and you'll never get a copy if you hear good about it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You have to go the digital route, and I still can't take it. I have an iPad, and it's not that I can't. I just, there's something about the experience that I just lose. It's a psychological thing, I know, but...
Nah, I still haven't really gone over... I'll read some stuff digital, but I still haven't... I usually will... I'm willing to make the extra effort to track down an issue in print and wait for it you know, to come if I have to mail order it or something, as long as it's not totally ridiculous price. But yeah, some of the stuff I've kind of gotten the same way where, you know, I'm just ordering number ones, and if it's something that I'm really sure that I'm going to like, I'll just keep ordering it. Like, you know, this month is the start of a new Greg Rucka series from Image to pre-order.
Lazarus, yeah.
Yeah, and I think, isn't it Michael Lark, the artist?
Oh, yeah, I love his stuff.
Yeah, so I love both the writer and the artist, so it's, I'll just, I'm confident enough that I'll like anything the two of them do together, so yeah. I'll just keep ordering those issues. But other stuff, maybe, because a lot of times, if you're not going to collect them, some of these number ones, like, you can turn around and make a decent amount of cash on it and just buy the trade.
Yeah. That the Riley Rossimo one, Dia de los Muertos, I don't know how to pronounce it, but it means Day of the Dead or something like that. Mm-hmm. Man, that was good. Holy crap. It was like done in like magazine style. Like, mm-hmm. It was huge. And the art just blew me away, and it was kind of like a Tales from the Crypt. Like, it have like four or five stories in it.
Yeah.
And I just loved it. I ate that sucker up, and I never ordered it. I mm-hmm. just saw a number two on the shelf, and I said, that's a weird cover, and it's a weird size. Like, it's something that jumped out at me and said, it's just weird looking. And then I opened it up, and I said, wow, that art is something that I've always liked Riley Rossimo's art. And but some of the stuff that he does, I don't like. Like, mm-hmm. some of the guys who write the stories, I'm not crazy about. Mm-hmm. But this time I picked it up and I said, I want to try this, but this is a number two. And then I was like, ah. And then I asked the comic shop, do you have a number one? And he goes, no, I don't. But he said, I have some delinquent pull box customers that haven't paid me in a long time. He said, let me go look. And he found number one. And then I was like, wow, this is great.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. He puts up with some crappy customers. I mean, I don't always go through him, but I like to go to that shop. I get most of, you know, the big stream stuff, but he's got customers that just don't ever tell him, you know, close my box. And then he keeps going and ordering shit for him. And I'm like, you got to stop that.
Yeah.
Or you got to call him and say, are you going to pick up your stuff? Or
yeah, or have just, you know, post some kind of policy that, you know, if you don't pick up your box for like 3 months or something like that, you know,
mm-hmm.
I'm going to close the box and sell what you haven't picked up, or, you know. But
yeah, so you got another book you want to talk about?
Yeah, I got a bunch of stuff because I have some stuff I had read
previously.
Before.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, you know what I wanted to ask you is, you said you had the Flash Chronicles Volume 1. Do you have that?
Yeah, I have Volume 1 and 2.
I was wondering if you wanted to delve into Volume 1, just like the first issue, just to see how it goes, just because, you know, Carmen Infantino had passed away. And
yeah, that's a good idea. I read a little bit of it when I first got them, and but that was a while ago, and I keep, you know, like I said, I mean, I've been really trying to read some of the stuff that I have lately instead of like constantly buying new stuff.
Yeah
it's hard to do, but because I'll just, you know, I'll hear about something on a podcast, or, you know, read about something online, and so, oh, I want to read that now and meanwhile, I have all this stuff sitting here to read.
Yeah, that's the thing about that I at least have the benefit of doing, because I buy so much, is yeah. I definitely read for the mood. Like,
mm-hmm.
I get so much that I don't have to struggle. Like, I don't feel like this. And I think that's why I like so much. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I very run across a comic book that I don't at least like at some level. Like, I hardly ever have a 2 out of 5, and the only 1 out of 5 I think I've ever given was Wake. I forget what the title was, but it was a Zenoscope book that was absolutely terrible. Oh, it's Wake the Fuck Up. That was the book I absolutely hated. It wasn't even like a comic. It was like they threw some art pages on and then threw some prose on it. And I was like, what the fuck is this? That's exactly what it's called. Wake the fuck up or wake the fuck up. And I was like, what the fuck? That was like a decent what the fuck.
It's like, what the wake the fuck up. You shouldn't have bought this shit. yeah, that sounds pretty bad. That reminds me more of like a zero issue or a free, like an image, or not image, but like a Wizard magazine throw in or something.
Yeah, it was weird. It was by Bill Hemmes, which he was popular in the day. I was interested in it just by name.
Mm-hmm.
That was a disaster. But what else you got? Because I know you read a lot last time, and you didn't really get to touch on it because we ran really late.
Yeah. Well, one other thing I read last time was a couple issues of Batman Legend of the Dark Knight, the old series. It's issues 74 and 75. It's a two-part story by Ted McKeever. He pretty much does everything but the colors and the letters. So he's the writer and the artist on it. And the name of the story is Engines. It's pretty interesting. It's like kind of one of those stories where Batman, he's not the point of view character. He's kind of more of like of a background force in the city. The main character is this guy that works in a slaughterhouse. So it starts off, there's all these images of cow carcasses strung up, and he's kind of a sort of a depressed character. He's meditating on, just the whole, in the captions, he's kind of talking about the whole, process of, the machines processing the meat and, the blood flowing down in gallons between the boards into the soil of the city, and it's a very kind of poetic approach to the writing. Something ends up happening to him that leads him to become more and more frustrated with living in Gotham and the violence of the city and stuff, and he decides to arm himself, and he starts training his body and working out, and he becomes a vigilante. He goes out with just kind of a red bandana over his eyes and a gun and a sword and just this kind of ad hoc costume, and meanwhile, there's panels of Batman watching him from the rooftops, and you could, that Batman's keeping tabs on this guy and watching him to see what he's going to do. He ends up getting himself in trouble and almost gets run over by a train. Batman saves him at the last minute. They don't really communicate, but, Batman's this sort of awe-inspiring figure, and the way that throughout the issue he's talking about different machines, like the machine of the city, the machine of the locomotive, the machines in the slaughterhouse, and he's trying to make himself into a machine, and when he stands face to face with Batman, he's impressed with him as like a machine of the human body. In the second issue, as the story continues, as Batman is wont to do, he's kind of discouraging him from being a vigilante and getting himself hurt. And he's more of like a Punisher type, willing to do violence than Batman is. And in the second issue, there's an actual sort of machine that's born of the underground, born of the sewers, that that comes out of the underground into the city and starts wrecking havoc. And this guy that, you know, this guy is trying to combat this creature, and Batman shows up and he sees Batman through this different perspective. He kind of sees Batman as he supposedly really is, and he appears as this kind of white knight. He recognizes that, you know, that he's kind of ashamed of his own inadequate ability to be a hero in the way that Batman has, you know, what Batman's accomplished is just beyond anything that he can do himself. He kind of, earlier on, he's kind of critical in some ways of Batman, like he's not doing a good enough job, but he sees that, like he says, he calls him elegance at its most decadent, poetry and decay, immaculate plateau. And that, you know, he's ashamed of the fact that he's willing to kill, and Batman is this kind of like knight that that manages to hold to this higher standard, and he gives Batman his sword as a way of like kind of surrendering. And but ultimately, you know, he kind of makes a last heroic act, there's kind of a nice resolution of appreciation between him and Batman. So it was a really cool story. It's one of the things that's kind of neat about the Legends of the Dark Knight series is that there's these gems throughout the run, these short little stories that just play with the Batman mythos. And Ted McKeever, you know, he obviously has a very unique style. So it was definitely a different sort of different take on things. It was a neat little story.
Yeah, I just recently picked up an Image book by him, Ted McKeever's Miniature Jesus.
Hmm.
Yeah, I think he's more, I don't know if I've read much by him, but he's more known for indie stuff, right?
And yeah.
That was one thing that also was neat about the title was that they did bring in artists and creators and kind of let them do their own thing, you know?
Yeah, I have most of this series, but I know I'm missing a lot because this was one title that I would drop out of because the creators would keep changing. Like, yeah. Oh, if anything I could cut, and I was behind in, I can cut this one because you have a 3-story arc or a 4-story arc or a 2-story arc, and then, which is awesome because it's like a done in one and it's kind of set on its own.
Yeah.
I'm just going to tell a Batman story. So.
Yeah, it didn't really connect into the, you know, the main series, other series at the time. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, I have just kind of random issues, you know, because they would even have, they'd have multi-part stories, but then they would even have done-in-ones also.
I have those issues and I've read them, but I don't remember them. Like you're describing them. I just don't remember it.
Yeah.
And that was from 2000. So I think it gets harder and harder for me to remember things because I read so freaking much. And unless it's like punching me in the face, like this is, I don't remember it a lot.
Yeah. And sometimes your memory on its own might not retain it, but then, you know, if you picked up the issue and maybe looked at a few pages, you might find your memories of it come back. You know?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And I have that happen where I'll look at the cover and think, I know I read this, but I don't really remember it. And then I flip through a couple pages and, all of a sudden I remember more of it than I thought I did.
Yeah. Such a weird cover because it looks like Batman smiling like with 2 layers of teeth.
Yeah. Yeah, and if you look at issue 75, it shows what he looks like as this white knight. So it actually is kind of nice because the first issue, he looks kind of demonic, and it kind of represents the way the guy sees Batman at first. And then second issue where he kind of changes his perspective on Batman. You know,
and now he's a hero, yeah.
Yeah. So it does kind of, when after you've read the story and look back at the covers, they kind of make sense.
Cool.
Yeah.
What else you got?
What else did I read? I read a 4-part story from Epic Comics called The Last American.
Was that a Dark Horse?
Or was it Epic?
Okay.
Yeah.
I know Dark Horse did a revamp of that.
Yeah, I think there was something else. This came out in 1990 and 91. I think it kind of wrapped around the year there. This is a British creative team that are all associated with Judge Dredd. You got Alan Grant and John Wagner are the writers, and they worked together a lot until up to a certain point where they kind of split ways. And then Michael McMahon is the artist. And I mean, I just know that he did some Dredd also from looking him up. I'm not real familiar with his work, but I really like it. It has a, I don't know if I'm great at describing art, but it has a kind of Chaykin style to it, to a small extent. It doesn't, you wouldn't think, oh, that's Chaykin, but it does in the sense that it has this kind of, the features of the faces are exaggerated somewhat in a little bit of a cartoony style, but yet there's a lot of detail to it, more detail than you would necessarily expect from a cartoonish style. And this series is a post-apocalyptic story where the last American is woken up by these three robots. I think one's Archie. Basically, they're A, B, and C. They have the letters on their chests. And A is kind of... or rather, C has kind of like got this funny personality because he's been watching television for years and years while the last American's in like a cryogenic chamber. And then A and B are kind of more like grunt, don't say a lot, just muscle. But they're programmed to wake him up at a designated time. He's Ulysses S. Pilgrim is his name. And as the story goes on, it fills in the backstory of how he was chosen to be frozen and woken up at a certain time to go out and search America and try to find life and start life again. He's basically invested, as the last American, he's invested with all the power of, you know, all the authority of America. He represents basically... you know, America at this point by himself. And it's a neat sort of meditative story where, you know, he's traveling alone with these robots and it gets into his head and how he deals with the solitude. He starts to, you know, hallucinate. There's these, he goes to New York City and he's seeing these, dancing skeletons, singing the, you know, New York, New York song, but like changing the lyrics to be kind of like depressing, end of the world kind of comedy. And they're doing, it's almost like he sees them doing this like stage show throughout the city. So it deals with kind of his psyche and his hopes is, you know, he thinks he might have found people and, you know, whether he finds people or not and how he responds and reacts to that. And, you know, it has at moments a little bit of a surrealism, like I said, the stuff that he's imagining, but it stays pretty grounded in terms of the narrative and you understanding what's going on.
Are they co-writers or is it different? Okay.
Yeah, they co-wrote the whole series. They really worked together a lot, I guess, up to they sort of had a falling out. I think not long after. This might have been one of the last things they worked on together.
Oh, so you did some research and you know they had a falling out? Like, they don't like each other anymore? Or?
I don't know as it stands today. But, you know, I think... I'm going to look it up.
Because Alan Grant... was like my favorite. I mean, just I have fond memories of him doing Batman, like in Detective, right. And that was the Breyfogle years or whatever. Yep. Oh my God, I just that was like my Batman, like where I wanted to read it every month, and I just loved it. And the Batmobile looked crazy, and it was just awesome. So I would be interested in checking this out. This not. For one thing, I like post-apocalyptic shit.
Right.
So this sounds pretty cool.
Yeah, I liked it a lot. And the art, I really like the art style. It's really cool, really detailed. And the coloring, I should mention also, I think is part of the overall effect. That kind of, it also has somewhat, it's colorful, but the palette is somewhat limited. Not, you know, it's not extremely limited, but the landscape is done in a lot of like grayish blues, and you know, the robots and other machinery, this tank that they used to travel around in, is all done in this kind of like sea green. So it kind of has an interesting palette. That there's a lot of like reds on the horizon. It really gets across the feel of this world that's basically been bombed into, you know, just rubble and destructed. So yeah, I got it really cheap for the four issues, and definitely recommend it.
Yeah, and this wasn't redone by Dark Horse. I was getting it confused when you said Last American. I was getting it confused with The American.
Oh, okay.
Which was a Dark Horse book.
Yeah, one thing I did, I noticed this when it was in previews recently and didn't pick it up. There was the recent Tank Girl series.
I jumped on it.
what is it, Kiroika?
Yeah.
That's the same artist.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Was it the Tank Girl series that's just coming out from Titan?
Yeah.
Okay. Because decided to grab that, and I have never experienced Tank Girl, so I just went on a Titan thing. I said some of these titles look pretty interesting.
Yeah. So that's Mick McMahon, the artist. He's Mike McMahon.
Looks very unique. I could see the Chaikin. How you're comparing it to Chaikin, it's very different, but like if you look at the cover to number 3, the body structure looks like Chaikin, and I can see where you're saying the faces.
Yeah, like here's something describing his style on Wikipedia. It says his art is blocky, all straight, edgy lines, and enclosed flat areas of deep, vivid color, stylized yet straight-faced. Perfectly straddling the low-key realism of the story and Pilgrim's increasingly desperate mental state. So that's specifically talking about The Last American. And he looks like he took a long break from doing a lot of comics work. He's done some work in computer game design and other stuff.
Something that makes money.
Yeah. But he's British, done a lot of like 2000 AD, Judge Dredd stuff and some Doctor Who stuff. So yeah, I really like the art. Story is really good. It's not plot heavy. It's more kind of exploring what it's like for this guy, like, you know, in his mental state of dealing with being alone, except for these robots, and trying to hold on to his sanity when, you know, he, you know, there's suggestions and you get some ideas of what may have happened, and you get some suggestions of other people, but it's not really about, you know, this big story or this big plot. It's more kind of exploring the idea.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. You mentioned the ABC robots. Well, they, you know, Fleetway had a comic called ABC Warriors, which was, you know, from 2000 AD.
Mm-hmm.
Except here it stood for atomic, bacterial, and chemical.
Yeah, each of the letters stands for, I think it's like Archie, or I think C is Charlie or something like that. Each one of them has like a name that starts with that letter, but it's hard not to think of them just by the letter because that's what's on their chest.
Yeah. I wish reading comics was an occupation because I think I'd love to do that.
Sure, you're not the only one.
You got anything else?
Did you have anything else that you're...
No, really? I'm tapped. I was so busy into the Image this last couple weeks that...
Yeah.
I read some DC last night so we could talk about some DC comics, but other than that, I read The Green Goblin, which was a lot of issues. That was 16 issues.
Right.
And then I read, the Howard Chaykin Scorpion, and then the obviously we finished off the Jack Kirby stuff.
Yeah, which we'll get to that. Did you wanna? I did see that you got some questions on Facebook. If you want to go.
Yeah, we could do that. All right, from Donnie Salvo, which I want to thank because he sent me some comics. I don't know if I thanked him on this episode or not. I read one of them he sent me so far. It was a Jerry Lewis comic. Always interested in the comedian. Yeah, it was The Adventures of Jerry Lewis from DC Comics. It had a pretty long run, and this was towards the tail end of the series. And it has like three short stories. And it was pretty cool. I liked it.
When did those come out? Approximately.
Let me look it up real quick. I have my database up here. Mm-hmm. Adventures of Jerry. I only have like four issues of it.
Yeah.
It ran from 1957 to 1971.
Oh, okay. I guess that I could kind of makes sense be when he was most popular.
And this Jerry Lewis was towards the tail end. It was issue 121. And it was pretty cool. It had a Hatful McCoy type story where he got involved in that. And that was my favorite. And then it had a one where he was trying to lock up his bike and it got stolen and he got involved into like a fire that was happening and ended up finding the criminals that stole his bike. And it was pretty funny. It's not hilariously funny, but it is funny because it's kind of a goofy take on this. And I think this started off as The Adventures of Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis, and then eventually became, Jerry Lewis.
Gotcha.
And
sometimes things can be funny without making you laugh out loud.
Yeah, and the art is kind of comical, like something that looks at a magazine or something. It was pretty cool. I liked it.
Cool.
But he asked us what our favorite cereal is, and I think we had some cereal discussion a little bit in one of the episodes. But mine is definitely Fruity Pebbles. I mean, as a kid. I don't know if it is now.
Right.
I'll have a bowl every now and then, but Fruity Pebbles was definitely my favorite.
Yeah, I think somehow we ended up talking with Trenchcoat about cereals, but I think it just was a tangent.
No, I think somebody asked it because...
Oh, really? Okay.
They had mentioned Freakies, which, like, did you ever see Freakies or something? And now that I know what Freakies is... That was a damn good cereal. It just didn't last long. And they had, like, cool-ass toys. But I tend to like the sweeter. I think my parents wanted me to have the healthier cereals, but I didn't want them. And if I had Cheerios, I would coat them in sugar. I would, like, take the sugar thing and I'd put tons of sugar.
Yeah. My favorite was probably Peanut Butter Crunch. Captain Crunch, Peanut Butter Crunch.
Yeah. It's weird because I like peanut butter, but I just do not want to try it. It's like I don't want to put milk in my peanut butter. I don't know why.
Yeah, I'll take peanut butter any way I can get it, I guess.
Yeah.
I'm still a big peanut butter fan. I don't eat that cereal anymore, but my second choice probably would be Cinnamon Toast Crunch.
Never had that.
I was into that too. That was pretty good.
All right, this one's from Norbert Franz. He's in Germany. It looks like he's going to a con today. He says, this one I think is going to pertain more to you than me. Who was your favorite character in 80s cartoons that had vehicles? I think what he's meaning, like masks, you know, like Mask mm-hmm. Jason, the Wheeled Warriors, or Galaxy Rangers. I think he's like heading towards like a cartoon that had toy properties that had vehicles.
Yeah.
Any particular stories to do with that? And did you guys have a lot of Mattel Hot Wheels? I can answer the last one, but go ahead. Did you have any that were, well, I'm sure G.I. Joe, right?
Yeah, that was the first thing that came to mind, though. I mean, G.I. Joe definitely did a lot of vehicles. I know they didn't necessarily, even though you had some of the vehicles came with a figure that kind of went with it, you don't really have a one-to-one, you know, this character has this vehicle, this character has this vehicle, in which I think a lot of the ones that he gave examples of kind of like that.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the ones he mentioned I haven't heard of personally.
Yeah, I haven't heard of Jason the Wheeled Warriors or Galaxy Rangers, but I did hear a Mask. And the only reason I know of Mask is because DC put out a comic called Mask.
That's right, yeah.
I never watched it.
I did watch Mask. That was the one that I knew. And that, maybe just because he mentioned it made me think of it, but that was definitely an example of a show where each character was directly tied into a number of vehicles, and the one that's most recognizable to me is, you know, the biggest character, the guy that like led the team, Matt Tracker.
Mm-hmm.
He had a Chevy Camaro, a red one that could turn into a jet plane. It's called Thunderhawk, and you know, basically the doors would flip up and those would turn into the wings.
Mm-hmm.
I always used to think that one was cool. So that was probably one of the most memorable ones for me. I don't really have any stories connect to, you know, playing with the toys or watching out. I haven't gone back and watched any Mask, but I think, you know, it was pretty, you know, heavily tied into the toys. I don't know naturally G.I. Joe's and Transformers were too, but they sort of stand out because the stories in the show were decent also.
Yeah.
I don't know if Masks really stands up or not, but that was Mobile Armored Strike Command. But I always liked their enemies was Venom, which stands for Vicious Evil Network of Mayhem, which I think is kind of an awesome acronym.
Yeah.
We're vicious and evil.
Yeah, I think when toys started to tie into cartoons, I was dropping out. With the exception of, like, the Marvel cartoons, I would stay watching them, you know? Mm-hmm. Spider-Man, the Hulk, and whatever was on Superman. But, yeah, I didn't watch Mask. I didn't watch G.I. Joe. I didn't watch Transformers. I didn't watch any of these. So, and at the time, the only toys I would buy are Star Wars, and they didn't have a cartoon.
Yeah.
I would buy Star Wars toys and I'd buy the superhero toys that were like DC or Marvel, but nothing that was tied in directly to a cartoon.
Well, what about Superpowers?
Superpowers didn't have I guess it did have a cartoon later on. It was like Super Friends, Legends of something or another, Superpowers something.
Mm-hmm.
That's with the Dark Side, and it had Firestorm and Cyborg on there. That one did tie into it. And I didn't have, when that cartoon was coming out, they had already come out with the first two Superpowers waves. And the third wave that had Cyborg and Firestorm, I never got.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I never got it. And they didn't really have vehicles. I think focuses around vehicles. They might have had. I wasn't a huge vehicle fan. I mean, I had. I'm definitely coming from. I'm aging myself, but I had a lot of vehicles from Big Jim's pack. I had the camper truck and the Corvette that had the lasers, and I had the Mago Green Arrow car, and the Spider car that had a webbing on it. But other than the the vehicle wise, I didn't get a lot, with the exception of Star Wars, a lot of spaceships and stuff. But yeah,
you're like keeping the memory of Big Jim alive through the Geek Crunch Retrocast.
I was a huge fan of Big Jim. I still have him. I have photos I took. I just don't know where I really want to put them on here, because I had dug them out of my basement recently. Mm-hmm. And everything is in good shape. I really kept those in good shape. So the Hot Wheel question, do you have a lot of Mattel Hot Wheels? I had a racetrack when I was a kid, and you would like have this thing that would spin. You put the Hot Wheel in and you'd spin it, and then they'd race around the track and go around the loop. But I didn't have many Hot Wheels. I had maybe like 5 Hot Wheels, and the rest of the cars I had were Matchbox. And I didn't have a lot of them. I was more into the Tyco. I don't know if anybody knows what the Tyco racetracks were like, but they had like a little thing that these were like electronic racetracks that you would put cars on. And I had this 57 Chevy that was like awesome. And my dad made us a track, and he like glued it to this fold out board in the garage. So when we were playing, he'd take the car out of the garage, he'd bring the track down, and then we'd have friends over, and everybody would bring over their Tyco cars, and we'd race. And the Tyco track that I had wasn't like you could switch lanes or anything. It was like you had 2 tracks and you'd race. But those were the cars that I had. Recently, though, I've been getting into Hot Wheels, the DC Comics Hot Wheels.
Yeah, I was going to say, I know you've posted a picture of recent ones that you've gotten.
Yeah. And my wife has gotten into the Muppets one, so we're kind of collecting Hot... I've kind of gone out of toys and went into Hot Wheels. It's weird. I think I'll get in the Hot Wheels because they're smaller, and I wouldn't stop the toys, but it's easier for me to store Hot Wheels than it is to do toys anymore.
Yeah, they take up a little less space than like CoverGirl statues.
yeah.
But I had some Hot Wheels. I had some Matchbox, but I never really had a lot. I never got super into them, or I have really any memories attached to owning them. I guess I just never been a big car guy in any regard.
Unless it had a Joe in it,
right? Yeah, or the Dukes of Hazzard or something.
Did you have Dukes of Hazzard cars? Really?
I think I had. I like the show. I didn't have like the. I know I've seen
the dolls,
actual dolls and toys and stuff. I don't think I had that, but I think I had the General Lee Matchbox or something.
Oh, cool.
But, I was more interested. I like the action figures a lot more, the characters, stuff.
All right, so the next question is favorite Transformers toy from the 80s. I didn't have any because I didn't get Transformers.
Yeah. Now, I did have some. Mostly, when it comes to Transformers, my memory is of being jealous of my next door neighbor Angelo because he had a lot of Transformers, but for whatever reason, I always had more Star Wars and G.I. Joe stuff and some He-Man. But so the ones I actually remember the ones the most are ones that I didn't own and my next door neighbor did. And my favorite was always Soundwave, the dude with the cassette deck in his chest.
Yeah, that looked cool. Didn't they have a Soundwave that actually played a cassette or no?
I don't know.
I don't remember.
Probably. But I always, for some reason, I always liked stuff that had compartments. Like whenever I played with Lego sets and stuff, it used to always fascinate me when there were, you know, secret doors and things like that. And so I just loved that you could pop open, you know, his chest and pull out the cassette, and then the cassette would transform into a bird. And then they had, add-on packs of more. There were 4 more cassettes that you could buy, and you could, you know, put different ones in them. So, but he had like the really classic ones. He had Optimus Prime and Megatron. So, He was on the, and those are some of the, those were like in the very first wave of the toys. So he was, his parents had him on the Transformer Brigade early on. I don't remember what ones, if I had that many myself. I do, whether it was mine or his, I do remember Jazz, who was like the little, little sports car. And Prowl, I think Prowl is the police car, but yeah, Soundwave was definitely my favorite because of the cassette tapes. And back then, he actually, I actually was listening to cassette tapes.
Yep, that was, I still have a lot of cassette tapes. All right, so the next question is, what is your favorite decade for comics? This is an interesting one because I think things have changed. I'm going to do a what it was and what it is. My favorite decade of comics for a long time, and this is going to make people laugh because it's an area that's looked down upon, but the 90s. I'm going to justify the 90s with, it was an exciting time for me in comics because a lot of companies were popping out, and the one that popped out that I absolutely loved and I read everything from was Valiant. And I continue to support it and love it in the new incarnation. And that's why it was my favorite. I felt like I knew everything about this universe, and I kind of grew along with it, even when it went to Acclaim. And I've always loved it. And it was an exciting time because Image exploded. Like, I don't have a lot of fond memories of it now, but at the time, I was really excited when Image exploded. My favorite period now... is definitely the 70s, the Bronze Age. I think the Bronze Age was like a very diverse time. Like, they were experimenting with diverse characters and diverse situations, and there was a lot of experimentation that went on with monsters and horror and all kinds of things that I became fascinated with. And I'm from a retro perspective, the 90s are an area that every time I dip my toe in, I think that these comics were way ahead of their time. I think that I can read a lot of 70s books now and have, like, we're doing it now with Jack Kirby and stuff.
Yeah.
And I'm just loving the hell out of that period. So, like, right now, that's my favorite, but a couple years ago, I probably would have said the 90s for Valiant. How about yourself? Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that that's a valid description of the Bronze Age. It definitely was a lot of transition. I kind of going off of that, I would say the 80s for me, you know, maybe years ago for me, I would have just said what's current, you know, because I was really into, you know, exploring new series and stuff, but and not looking back as much. But for me, I think it was 80s, like the main... bulk of my collection, really the stuff that I do actually collect and hang on to is 80s DC stuff. It's kind of what I focus on. And, you know, I just find the 80s really interesting because when it started off, the first few years of the 80s are similar in a lot of ways to the Bronze Age. There's some kind of carryover. And especially with a company like DC, you have Crisis sitting smack dab in the middle of the, you know, of the decade that changed so much. But not just Crisis, but also with Jeanette Kahn at DC, you know, you had, you know, Legends, you know, you had The Dark Knight, and you had Watchmen, and Ronin and other stuff that Frank Miller did that really kind of changed the industry, you know, and the rise of a lot of these indies that I'm going back and checking out for the first time. You had a lot of creators owning their own properties and getting to experiment with starting new characters and stuff. So, yeah, it's definitely for me the 80s, I think, would be my favorite.
Yeah, that's a hard question to answer because I've always had favorites. I don't think there's ever been a bad decade in comics. I don't, at least since I've been reading, because I've always had favorites in every decade. But those are the two that stand out, like, in my mind. Mostly because of Kirby 70 stuff. It's like, and a lot of the horror I'm reading. Oh, the other thing I forgot to mention, I did read something else, but I don't want to get into it a lot, but I think you might be interested in hearing what I read. I read Jack Kirby's Spirit World, which was a magazine that DC took a chance on when Jack Kirby first came to DC Comics before he got into these books that we're reviewing. He wanted to experiment with magazines, and he thought that Jack Kirby was like a visionary. He was always like popping ideas of like where the industry was headed and where he thought he could tap into. And unfortunately, Spirit World didn't take off, but it was a very weird, he wrote and drew it. And, he was, dealing with the supernatural, but like through a psychiatrist who was like trying to find out if facts were real or not. And then he would, you know, deal with like spontaneous combustion and shit like that, like things that were talked about. And it was a very interesting magazine. The art was really, really good. And I am glad I bought it. It was a hardcover, reprinted it. The magazines are very hard to find. And the reason it's such a hard magazine to find is because they didn't really know what to do with it. In other words, a lot of the magazines got stuck in warehouses and never shipped. And the very few stores that actually put them on the shelves, because they were like, what is this? Is it a comic? Is it a magazine? What do I do with it? And a lot of them just stayed in boxes and I think were eventually destroyed. So I think the magazine itself is worth like $100, but that I'd like to talk about that if you ever read it. It's pretty interesting stuff, especially if you're a Kirby fan.
Yeah, I remember seeing that solicited. Sounded pretty cool.
But again, he was messing with that photo stuff, you know.
Yeah.
Very, very crazy shit. What he was doing. I think the man is just freaking amazing. So, if you were stranded on an island and could have one comic, what would it be? One comic. Wow.
Oh God.
Couldn't even take a trade. I would just take OMAC number one. But I'd be happy with any of Kirby's Fourth World stuff because I could read it and then I could just stare and look at the pictures instead of just reading it, because I get both of I get both something, a story I'm going to enjoy, and the art I could just stare at. And it'd be OMAC because I think OMAC is my favorite work from Kirby. Mr. Miracle's damn a close second, though.
Yeah. Man, that's a really tough question.
One comic. You can't even take Crisis on Infinite Earths.
I know, I'm trying to think of something that has a lot going on in it. Like Alan Moore stuff, a lot of times there's stuff going on in each panel in the background that you could look at and take in, you know. But one issue of his stuff, a lot of times it's, you know, it's like a big story that has multiple parts, so. That's tough. I guess I'll go with New Teen Titans number one. Just because it's fresh in my mind, because I added it to my collection recently and introduces like the, you know, characters and stuff like that.
Good art and good story. You need both if you're stranded on an island.
Yeah.
Something that you can read over and over again.
Maybe I come up with something else. If it's not really the pinnacle of that run or anything like that, but
yeah. Hope I'm never in that situation.
I know, it's just like I'd have to think about that one for a lot longer to really come up with a good answer, I think.
If it was a trade, I would definitely take an omnibus with me so I have more quantity. Either that or, you know, a Marvel omnibus or a Kirby omnibus, something that has a lot of content. Because I'd be going for content.
Right.
Okay, yeah. I think that's it for questions. Do you want to dig into the Fourth World Omnibus, which finishes...
Yeah, we had 2 issues left, I think.
Yeah.
Yep, finishing up Volume 2. We got Funky Flashman this time, a.k.a. Stan Lee.
You think he was he was created to be Stan Lee?
Yeah,
that's
his
stab. Have you read anything that said that?
Yeah, it actually even says something, I think, in the Mark Evanier says something. He doesn't say that it's Daniel Lee, but he just mentions that people talked about it as if they thought that's who it was supposed to be in the afterword. And
I guess he doesn't have fond memories of Stan Lee.
No.
I mean, he's betrayed as kind of like a jerk in here, but... He has the enthusiasm.
Right, but I think the way that the guy talks is making fun of Stanley's writing style.
Yeah.
Because it's just chock full of alliteration.
But he's also two-faced in this. Like, he's got two faces. One, he's like, he has a butler and, you know, he's walking around and he's a very strategic, and then he actually puts on another face and then he's somebody else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, he puts on, a toupee and a goatee or a fake beard. It's pretty unflattering. I mean, Funky Flashman is, you know, his whole appearance is fake. And his attitude, he's really shallow. And
there's a sense of greed too. I found it really interesting, and I don't even understand it, but he's in this house and he could stick his hand in the statue and get money, but the money's always decreasing. Mm-hmm. So like whoever he inherited this is like trying to teach him a lesson, like, I'm gonna wean you off of money. So if it is Stan Lee or based on Stan Lee, there's a lot of negative things that I can get out of this.
Oh yeah, very much so. I think he even looks a little like Stan Lee did, back in the 70s. At the time, and I can't see how it's not. I really can't. I mean, the way that he talks is a pretty spot on parody of Stan Lee's writing style.
Yeah.
You know, when he's just super, super fake and shallow. I'm not saying it's necessarily a totally accurate portrayal of Stan Lee, but it's a pretty, if you're going to parody and find things to make fun of about him, you know, because in the 70s, he was pretty much he pretty much left New York and for California and was hobnobbing with a lot of celebrities and getting... While it helped to get Marvel's name out there, but he was working to get, you know, movies made out of Marvel properties, and he was out of the day-to-day operations, you know, so you could kind of, I can really see it for sure.
I absolutely love this issue, though. God, it's hard for me not to give every issue of Mr. Miracle a 5 out of 5. Just not awesome. For one thing, Funky Flashman, so damn interesting. And mm-hmm. I didn't even read the back, so I didn't know the parallels, but now that you mention it, it's even more interesting to me. Like, yeah. I want to go read it again. But, God, this is such a great issue.
Yeah, I've been really loving Mr. Miracle a lot, and this is definitely up to the standards. Pretty awesome.
Such a cool concept, because he hasn't done anything heroic yet. He's kind of like a character that's like, I'm going to go blow myself up this week. What could I do for another show? And then he's got apocalyptic beings come after him every issue.
Yeah, it's almost as if most of his heroic stuff comes as a result of self-defense.
Yeah, it's awesome. Or escaping. It's amazing. This book, just phenomenal. And it opens up... Obviously, they introduce Funky Flashman, we talked about in kind of in detail. And then Oberon's launching him in a rocket sled.
Yeah, which the cover of this issue should mention is what's used for the cover of the omnibus.
Yeah.
It's the same cover of Mr. Miracle and the rocket sled.
Poor Oberon thinks he's dying again. Like he should freaking know by now.
I know.
He's like rocket sledding himself off a cliff, right?
Right. And I told him he didn't have a chance. Even if he got loose in time, he couldn't jump free of that speeding torch without being burned alive. And meanwhile, Mr. Miracle's floating down comfortably in a chair attached to a parachute behind him. Mm-hmm. Like, hey, over here. You're going the wrong way.
And I could just kill myself. I was thinking, I had did a Kickstarter recently, and one of the Kickstarter rewards was the I was getting a sketch from Tim Seeley. So I got to send in to Tim Seeley what I wanted. It was the Mini Comics Kickstarter one. That was based on Toys Lake.
Okay.
And this was a sketch, and I thought it was reasonable for a sketch based on what I pay at cons. So I was like, hey, I'm going to take advantage of this. Mm-hmm. And I told him I wanted the go-go skirt Elastigirl from Doom Patrol, because I love the go-go skirt Elastigirl. But damn it, this big Barda in this bikini outfit she wears, I would have loved to seen that.
You have to keep it in mind for next time, I guess. Yeah. And speaking of, you know, self-defense, and you know, this is kind of Big Barda has that issue as well, because she's left you know, the forces of Apocalypse as well at this point, mostly to be with Scott, but some of her villains come after this time. We get Mad Harriet, who is pretty wild looking. She's got like crazy green hair, she's all green skin. She's got like almost looks like scissor fingers, like Edward Scissorhands.
She's got like a gauntlet that has spikes on it.
Yeah. But when she's attacked, a little bit of trivia here that I found out from the afterword as well. The page where we get to see Big Barda taking a bath.
That was so sexy. Damn it.
Do you know that is the only page in the whole Fourth World Saga that was not written by Jack Kirby?
Really? The bathtub scene?
Yep, that page is, I didn't, you know, I found this out by reading the afterword. That page is actually written by Mark Evanier.
God bless him for putting that in there. God bless you, Mark.
Yeah, it was his idea, I guess. They
thank
they
you.
Realized when they were they were done, and he was an issue short. So Mark suggested, well, you have Big Barda saying that she's going to go take a shower, or she's going to go take a bath, rather. He said, why don't you have a page where you show her taking the bath, and you know, so you can just insert it there without interrupting the flow of the story or changing anything. And Kirby said, sounds good, write it for me. So he wrote it and tried to make it sound like Kirby just made like a few little, you know, word changes here and there and drew it. And Mark Evanier says that's whenever he reads the Fourth World Saga now, he skips over that page because he knows it wasn't written by Kirby. But I think that's silly, and I think it flows. I didn't notice.
I didn't notice at all either.
Would have never known. No way in a million years would I have known that if he didn't tell me in the afterword.
So he wrote it. Jack drew what he wrote. He said, yeah I'll draw that. It's cool because she's enjoying the pleasantries of Earth. She's like kind of making fun of it, but she's saying, damn, this is so soothing. You'd never find this kind of thing in apocalypse.
Yeah, I thought I liked the.
And then she gets out of the tub and it's like, ping, ping, ping. Mother Box is going nuts. She's like, oh, hell, something's going on. And then Mad Harriet's there ready to take her head off. And Mad Harriet's like berserker mode, female fury, like berserker Wolverine or whatever it is.
Either that or Mother Box is masturbating.
Yeah.
That's the ping, ping,
like,
ping.
Ting, ting, ting.
it's just a coincidence that there was danger. So Mad Harriet attacks. She's one of Big Bertha's compatriots from Apocalypse. And meanwhile, we got Mr. Miracle showing. So we didn't say, like, the whole reason Flashman is there is that he's kind of a Hollywood agent type. And, he acts like he's a big deal and he's not really.
But Barda, like, puts him in his place, I think.
Yeah. He tries to hit on her, doesn't he, kind of?
Yeah. Barda's just like, she doesn't fall for any of his bullshit.
Right.
That's what I like about it.
Yeah, he says, Chicky, booby baby. Did you think for 1 minute that Bitty Buddy Funky would be unkind to you? Because she freaked him out by, like, grabbing a gun and just smashing it in her hand. But yeah, that's kind of the way that Flashman talks. It's like, it's a parody of Stanley's, captions, really.
Yeah.
What a tingly-wingly thrill to actually be in the very setting where the hollowed Thaddeus Brown, like a warlock of ancient yore, conjured up his majestic manipulations.
Excelsior!
Yeah, exactly.
Throw that in there.
Yeah. And the characters even remark on the way that he talks, Oh, you sure have a way of speaking. You sure have a way of describing things.
But God bless Stanley. I'm not going to shit on him. He knew how to make people excited about comics.
Yeah. And I'm not either. It's just
he gets a lot of credit, but you still have to give him credit because I don't think Marvel Comics would be what it is today if he didn't get the excitement, and he knew how to promote comics and make them exciting for kids and make them feel like they were part of this universe. Like letters, pages, and his Excelsior. And even when he was with reporters, like in the articles I read in Tomorrow's Publishing, he would even get excited. People reporting on it excited about it. Even though the reporter knew that Jack was doing everything. Because the reporter wrote, Jack took a couple notes. about what the plot was going to be, which was like two sentences, and he turned it into a story. This comic book's freaking amazing. I mean, every time I read it, and just me talking about it is getting me more excited. Like, this is just so fucking awesome. Everything about this issue is perfect.
I think when it comes to Stan Lee, he deserves credit. Just he got so much credit, and others didn't. That a lot of the focus has been on trying to balance that back out and take some of the credit away from Stanley and give it back to some like to Kirby and Ditko. And I mean, and that's necessary. Like that should be the case. It's just like with Bob Kane and Bill Finger when it comes to Batman.
Yeah, definitely.
People got screwed over. I mean,
who knew how to work the industry was the one who got the more credit,
Right.
And Bill Kane, I mean, the thing about Bob Kane is a lot of things with Bob Kane's name came out of his studio. It wasn't even him.
Right.
So that is interesting too. I mean, we got to delve in that at some point, but
people didn't have the protection that they have today. And it's still not a perfect system, but so much has changed, you know, especially starting in the 80s. Over the last 20, 30 years, a lot of improvements have been made, and certain people got screwed over. And in a lot of ways, Jack Kirby got screwed over so bad that, you know, for him personally, I think it was probably really hard to forgive Stan Lee.
Yeah, and if what he did in today's world, he'd be a millionaire. I mean, he wouldn't be living like, and his family wouldn't be living. Probably he would have credit on the a lot more like on Hollywood property.
Right. Yeah,
and yeah, they do give him credit, but how much money do they give him for that? I mean, he freaking created 60% of the Marvel Universe.
Mm-hmm.
And his fourth world stuff is not popular, but damn it, I don't know why it isn't. Like, I read this today, and I'm just blown away of why it didn't catch a following, because it's so awesome. It is just, I mean, we're in a world today that's changed a lot, and stories have changed a lot, and its sophistication has changed a lot. But these stories, to me, still stand up as being brilliant.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think one way that they have shown their longevity is just by the persistence of some of these characters to continue. Maybe most of them aren't like A-list, but the fact that you still have, you know, Darkseid especially would probably be A-list, and then you have a lot of B-list characters that you know, haven't gone away, haven't been forgotten.
Or C-list.
Well, then there's, yeah, a lot of other ones even. You know, some that really haven't stuck around.
I would say Mr. Miracle's probably the second most popular. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's had like four titles, you know. And then he's in New Gods. I mean, he's in Earth 2 now that he popped up in the What the Fuck issue.
Yeah, he's definitely maybe not super prominent at the moment, but he's had some periods post-Kirby of heavy prominence and stuff like that. So, yeah, I think there's a definitely a legacy in that respect. But I know that even later on in life, Kirby was on a radio program, and Stan Lee called in to wish him, I think, it was for his birthday or something like that. And, you know, I think it's the farthest they got was that, like, being able to talk again and be cordial. But it was reading the transcript of the conversation, it was still a little bit awkward. And you could tell that, you know, Kirby, they weren't going to be ever become best buds again. You know, and I think that was fairly close to Kirby's passing away. So it's not like, I don't think they passed away with hate for the guy, but I don't think, you know, they were ever going to be buddy-buddy, even if he had lived another couple decades, you know?
Yeah, that's the one. I don't have many regrets in life, like everything I've ever done or any action I've ever done, but one thing I always wished I could do is meet that man. Of any creator, I wish I could just give him a hug and say, thank you.
Yeah, I wish you could meet him too. I'd like to say I'd want to meet him too, but I would have to, like, if it was between the two of us, I'd have to concede and let you have the opportunity.
Yeah, I'd be in tears.
I would contribute to that Kickstarter.
Yeah.
Mike Meyer meet Jack Kirby.
But this issue's phenomenal. He's doing some more traps in front of Funky Flashman, and he's amazed by his talents.
Yeah, and we kind of touched on the two main things that are going on this issue. You have, on the one hand, Mr. Miracle and Oberon are showing Funky Flashman all these crazy traps, and then you have Big Barda's, opponents, her former teammates coming back to try to get her. We already mentioned the one. Then you have Lashina, who comes up, who has like these ribbons that she uses. She's really pretty weird. She's got like straps wrapped around her body, and she like kind of unfurls one of them and uses it. It's kind of a weird character, probably not one of the most memorable of his, but pretty funny.
Really? Because if I think of the female Furies, that's who I think of.
Is it?
Yeah.
I guess just kind of a funny.
Because I think she shows up the most. Even in the cartoon, did you see Brave and the Bold when they had the big Barda thing?
I still haven't seen that episode. No.
Ah, it's great.
Well, what I really kind of enjoyed was that we get to see that Desaad is not an only child.
Yeah.
That he actually has a sister, and you can kind of tell that.
You can see the resemblance.
Yeah.
She's got to be the ugliest woman in comics next to a Granny Goodness.
Yeah.
But
oh, Butte.
One thing I wanted to point out now that you mentioned the Stan Lee thing, like, if this is really, is Funky Flashman steals the mother box.
Mm-hmm.
He puts it in his pocket.
Yeah.
I wonder if that's saying anything. You stole my life, you son of a bitch. You stole my wealth anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, considering the mother box is kind of like a source of power and ideas and stuff.
Yeah.
And no, it's not a very flattering. It's pretty rough portrayal and it does seem to be, you know, supposed to be Stan Lee. The other thing other than Stan Lee though that he reminded me of, just like because of his relationship with his houseboy, as he calls him,
mm-hmm.
Is Smithers in Burns from
sure
from The Simpsons.
Yeah.
But
what an asshole! In other words, they all come in because they track. The female Furies are tracking the mother box. Funky Flashman steals the mother box, goes back to his house where he's got a servant. And if this really is Stan, like I didn't read the back. Now I kind of want to read the back. But if it is Stan Lee, good Lord, he's really slamming him because he throws his servant right to the. He kills his servant. He like, hey, take this guy.
Yeah.
He sacrifices his servant so he can get away.
Yeah, that's pretty rough.
What a brilliant issue. So much happened. And we mm-hmm. first appearance of the female Furies, Mad Harriet, Stompa, Lasha, and what is her name? The can't remember Desaad's sister's name.
Oh, yeah.
I
know they say it. Because she doesn't really show up till later on in the end. You hear about her earlier on.
Yeah, but, I just can't remember her name. She's the brains behind it, like the sinister one. Stompa's kind of like, who's the guy from Inhumans that stomps down that has the thunder hoofs? Keth Gorgon.
Oh, right.
But, God, that's such a good issue. It makes me so excited. It's just such a, it's brilliant. And then you get some young Scott Free. That's how he's different. He's the only one that doesn't get assimilated by the Borg.
Yeah, some of the backups, are sort of toss-ups. But I do like when we get to see Scott Free. I think it's cool when we get to see Scott Free on Apocalypse.
The one thing I got a kick out of this two-page thing is the back stuff that Granny has signs all over. Die for Granny and she will live for you. That's brilliant! Cruelty breeds respect. You're not a beast if you kill for Darkseid. You're not a liar if you lie for Darkseid. I just loved reading the signs. That was my favorite part of the backup.
Yeah. So The other issue that we had was Jimmy Olsen.
145.
Yeah. So that, this kind of continues story from last time. This is called Brigadoon. And because we're still in Scotland, they had gone there to investigate the monster in the one lake. We get a nice big sort of splash page. It's technically three panels, but they're all different crazy creatures. Like there's a griffin. There is a chimera also.
I've never heard the fairy tale of a chimera. What is that story?
I don't know of a specific story other than I just know.
Well, I know of unicorns, and I've never seen basilisks.
But yeah, I know of it just like from D&D.
Mm.
I know Keith Knudsen knows what I'm talking about. Keith knows the chimera, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah, he loves this shit.
He's all about the beasts.
Yeah. Or the small vampire with lady friends.
Yeah, he likes vampire dwarves.
Dwarves, yeah.
Berserker dwarves. But
he gets excited about that stuff like I get excited about Jack Kirby. Yeah. I mean, he loves it. He loves that. Like he could do a D&D podcast and he would just be like, he has an enthusiasm like I do where he like would go real excited. Like, I don't know if you saw the video that I posted of him talking about Spartacus.
Yeah, I watched that. Yeah.
but he has that excitement about him that like I get when I get excited about something. Mm-hmm. I love that guy.
Where everybody else is kind of thinking like their reaction to you on DC Noise when you get talking about OMAC and Kirby and stuff is and Daryl kind of look at him and when he starts trying to talk about D&D and it ain't happening.
Yeah, those two will never get my love for, I mean, they know I love like Kirby, but they'll never feel it.
Does Daryl have something like that? Well, I'm trying to think if Daryl has something.
Spaghetti.
Spaghetti. Yeah, no one will ever love spaghetti as much as Daryl.
This is Daryl, yeah.
Nice.
So
we get the return of Mokari.
Yeah, those guys. Simeon. Those guys crack me up, actually.
The
scientists, like, they're like the scientists that are just like, let's do this. This is awesome.
Yeah, they're bad guys just because they don't want to have to follow any like ethical guidelines when it comes to their experiments.
Exactly, no ethical guidelines, no boundaries, and they just want to do their own thing. And they want funding so they could get it from like Darkseid.
Yeah,
some cash, and then they just kind of like do their own thing.
Yeah, which their own thing this time is messing with Jimmy Olsen.
Yeah. And then we get to see this creature called Angry Charlie. That's pretty awesome looking.
I think you cut out for me there for a minute. We get to see what?
Angry Charlie.
Oh, right.
And I thought this was kind of brilliant. Like, we had that Loch Ness creature. And They end up following it or trying to find Brigadoon, which is like a fairy tale city. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that they have what actually happens is they shrink down to like miniature size, and then Scrapper's they're the same size as Scrapper at one point. Scrapper Trooper, yeah.
Yeah.
That was awesome.
Yeah, because they come face to face with them. It's like the real Scrapper is freaked out because he's like, you ain't little anymore. Or is it that I ain't big anymore? And so they're like face to face with the trooper that that up until now had been carried around in his pocket. And it actually is kind of funny because so far there have been a lot of really huge creatures and monsters. And so now it looks the same, but technically, like Flipper Dipper is swimming naturally. And there's this giant fish, but it's really actually just, it looks giant because he's small. And it's just really just a normal sized trout. But it looks the same as we're used to kind of seeing these huge monsters so far that Kirby draws.
Yeah, it's like the whole crew goes underwater in the car while Scrapper and Jimmy Olsen go on land. And they all end up in the same place where Makari and Simeon are. And they capture... I actually love this because we all know that in the Silver Age, Jimmy has been Turtle Boy and he's been all kinds of characters, Alaska Lad and all that. And here they're experimenting on him. They capture him and they're going to jack his world up again.
They basically turn him into like prehistoric Olsen or like an ape Olsen, which is funny because Simeon is kind of that way. So it's almost like Simeon is like the inspiration.
Yeah.
Like making him look more like him. That's pretty funny. We don't really see, like, he's being experimented on halfway through the issue. That's like kind of our, you know, the last thing we get to see is what he looks like now.
Didn't see a whole lot of Superman other than Superman and Duplex are going after those musical dudes from Apocalypse.
Yeah, you know, the other thing I think kind of interesting about Jimmy Olsen's transformation, the way that he looks, is that he kind of reminds me of the way that Orion looks like when you see his real face, you know, in some ways, because his... You know, when he's doing his apocalyptic appearance, he kind of has a little bit, you know, he's got like a heavier brow and looks more like a previous, you know, evolution of a human.
Yeah. It was another good issue. Like, I'm looking forward to digging into volume 3. First, I have to go find it. That'll be the...
Well, do you want to, next time... We could take a 1 week or, you know, a one episode break from Fourth World and
let's go to the Flash Chronicles and read 3 stories out of there.
Yeah, we'll read like the first 3 issues in volume 1 or something.
Sure.
Just to break it up and then we can go into volume 3.
That sounds great.
Word.
This has been a good episode because I got a kick out of that. The highlights are obviously the Mr. Miracle. I just love that issue. That was so much happening.
That's pretty awesome. It's good to get caught up on stuff that I had kind of had sitting there to talk about. And
I had read that one last week and was excited about it last week. And then this week came along and I lost a little of enthusiasm and got excited again. So it just goes to show how good that stuff is.
And I know we had a request to talk about America versus the Justice Society. It's a 4-issue series. I started reading it, and I'll just talk about the whole thing probably next time.
Cool. That'll be awesome because refresh my memory.
Yeah. But it's pretty good. I like it a lot so far. But I kind of expected I would.
Well, good deal. Anything else you want to mention, or you want to wrap up?
I think we'll wrap up. I got to pee, and I'm pretty sure Luna has to pee, so we'll take care of some peeing.
Yes, I have drank 2 bottles of water since.
I'll just be like, I'll be like Buddy Blank, and I'll take a leak while she takes a leak out on the sidewalk.
Yeah, see if anybody stares at you.
Yeah. They're like, this is my house, bitches.
Well, this has been Geek Brunch Retrocast, episode 11. I'm Mike, and Chris was your other host, and you can reach us at geekbrunchpodcast.com, and you can send us Twitters or feedback on Twitter at MythMakingETC or at Mike Myers Brunch. We have a Facebook page, so you can go like that. If you go to Geek Brunch Podcast and click the like button there. You'll be able to follow like all the episodes and anything else that we post up there. You post all the covers, which is challenging because we have a lot of covers, even though we covered not a lot of books, we covered a lot of quantity.
Yeah, maybe with the trades, I'll just go with the cover of the trade.
yeah, I think
take the easy way out.
That's a good idea.
Rather than unloading like 16 Clone Wars.
Because I'd have had 16 out of that Green Goblin, and you would have had 10.
10 Animal Man covers in a row.
Yeah.
So they're out there on the internet if people really want to see them.
What else we got? Well, we got the forum for geeks. You could scroll down to Geek Brunch and you could see topic threads there. I post on my Facebook page usually the questions, so if you want to get part of that, you could either do that through Twitter. I usually do it the night before and then during the day, and or send me a request on Facebook and I'll add you. Anything else you want to mention?
I think that's it.
Cool.
Covered it pretty good.
Hey, did you read Harvest by chance? The Image comic called Harvest?
Is that a new one?
I think it's about 6 months old. It's about harvesting body parts.
No.
Okay. I just wanted to know.
Sounds interesting, though.
Yeah. All right. Well, what is your email again in case they want to send you an email?
Oh, it's mythmakingetc@gmail.com.
And I'm Mike at comicbooknoise.com. And leave us an iTunes review. We have one out there specifically for Retrocast. You could be number 2.
Yeah.
And we will talk to you again fairly shortly. I hope we can record one next week, but we'll see.
Yeah, I'll be in touch about that. It should be all right.
Okay.
And, yeah, it'll be nice to catch up. When we have these like month long breaks, you know, it feels like a long time. So.
And June is going to be really weird for me because there's so many cons. No, in May actually.
May, okay.
Yeah.
So yeah, it might be good to get another one in.
The more that we can bank, the better.
Gotcha.
All right. Well, we'll talk to you later, and you have a good Sunday.
Yeah, you too. Enjoy the day. All right. Bye.
Does it get easier?
No. Yes. It gets easier.
Oh, yeah? Look at you.
Thanks. The more you know who you are and what you want, the less you let things upset you.
Yeah. I just don't know what I'm supposed to be. You know? I tried being a writer, but I hate what I write. And I tried taking pictures, but they're so mediocre, you know? And every girl goes through a photography phase. You know, like horses. You know, take dumb pictures of your feet.
You'll figure that out. And I'm not worried about it. Keep writing.
But I'm so mean.
Mean's okay.
What about marriage? Does that get easier?
That's hard. We used to have a lot of fun. But you would come with me when I made the movies and we would laugh about it all. Now she doesn't want to leave the kids. And she doesn't need me to be there. The kids miss me, but they're fine. It gets a whole lot more complicated.
It's scary.
It's the most terrifying day of your life, the day the first one is born.
Nobody ever tells you that.
Your life, as you know it, is gone. Never to return. But they learn how to walk and they learn how to talk and you want to be with them. And they turn out to be the most delightful people you will ever meet in your life.